Chapter 60. That God is truth. It follows from what has been said that God himself is truth, for truth is a perfection of the intelligence or intellectual operation, as stated above. Now God's act of intelligence is his substance, and since this very act of intelligence is God's being, as we have shown, it is not made perfect by some additional perfection, but is perfect in itself, just as we have said about the divine being. It remains therefore that the divine substance is truth itself. Again, truth is a good of the intellect, according to the philosopher. Now God is his own goodness, as we have shown. He is also his own truth. Further, nothing can be said participatively of God since he is his own being which participates nothing. Now truth is in God, as was shown above. If, then, it be not said of him participatively, it follows that it is said essentially. Therefore God is his own truth. Moreover, although properly speaking the true is not in things but in the mind, according to the philosopher, nevertheless sometimes a thing is said to be true, in so far as it attains to the act of its own nature. Hence, Avicenna says in his Metaphysics, that the truth of a thing is a property of the nature immutably attached to it, in so far as that thing is naturally inclined to cause a true estimate of itself, and reflects the type of itself that is in the divine mind. Now God is his own essence. Therefore, whether we speak of the truth of the mind, or of the truth of the thing, God is his own truth. This is confirmed by the authority of our Lord, who says of himself, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Chapter 61. That God is the most pure truth. The foregoing being established, it is evident that in God there is pure truth, in which there can be no alloy of falsehood or deception, for falsehood is incompatible with truth, even as black with white. Now God is not merely true, but is truth itself. Therefore there can be no falsehood in him. Moreover, the intellect is not deceived in knowing what a thing is, as neither is the sense about its proper sensible. Now all knowledge of the divine intellect is as the knowledge of one who knows what a thing is, as was proved above. Therefore it is impossible that there be error, deception or falsehood in the divine knowledge. Further, the intellect does not err about first principles, whereas it does sometimes about conclusions, to which it proceeds by arguing from first principles. Now the divine intellect is not argumentative or discursive, as we proved above. Therefore there can be no falsehood or deception therein. Again, the higher a cognitive power is, the more universal and the more comprehensive is its proper object. Wherefore that which the sight knows accidentally, the common sense or the imagination apprehends as included in its proper object. Now the power of the divine intellect is absolutely supreme in knowledge. Therefore all things knowable are compared thereto as knowable properly and per se and not accidentally. But the cognitive power errs not about such things. Therefore it is impossible for the divine intellect to err about any knowable object. Moreover, an intellectual virtue is a perfection of the intellect in knowing things. Now the intellect cannot, according to an intellectual virtue, speak false, but always speaks true, because to speak true is the good act of the intellect, and it belongs to virtue to perform a good act. Now the divine intellect is more perfect by its nature than the human intellect is by a habit of virtue, for it is in the summit of perfection. It remains, therefore, that falsehood cannot be in the divine intellect. Further, the knowledge of the human intellect is somewhat caused by things, the result being that man's knowledge is measured by its subjects, since the judgment of the intellect is true through being in accordance with things, and not vice versa. Now the divine intellect is the cause of things by its knowledge. Wherefore his knowledge must needs be the measure of things, even as art is the measure of the products of art, each of which is so far perfect as it accords with art. Hence the divine intellect is compared to things as things to the human intellect. Now falsehood resulting from inequality between man's mind and things is not in things but in the mind. Wherefore if there were not perfect equality between the divine mind and things, falsehood would be in things but not in the divine mind. And yet there is no falsehood in things, because as much as a thing has of being, so much has it of truth. Therefore there is no inequality between the divine intellect and things, nor is any falsehood possible in the divine mind. Again, as the true is the good of the intellect, so is falsehood its evil, for we naturally desire to know the true and shun to be deceived by the false. Now evil cannot be in God, as was proved above. Therefore falsehood cannot be in him. Hence it is said, "But God is true and God is not as a man, that he should lie, and God is light, and in him there is no darkness." Chapter 62. That the divine truth is the first and supreme truth. From what has been proved, it clearly follows that the divine truth is the first and supreme truth. For the disposition of things in truth is as their disposition in being, according to the philosopher, and this because truth and being are mutually consequent upon one another, since the true is one that is said to be which is, and that not to be, which is not. Now God's being is first and most perfect, therefore his truth is also first and supreme. Again, that which belongs to a thing essentially belongs thereto most perfectly. Now truth is ascribed to God essentially, as we have proved. Therefore his truth is the supreme and first truth. Further, truth is in our intellect through the latter being equated to the thing understood. Now the cause of equality is unity, as stated in 5 Metaphysics. Since then in the divine intellect, intellect and thing understood are absolutely the same, his truth must be the first and supreme truth. Moreover, that which is the measure in any genus must be the most perfect in that genus, wherefore all colors are measured by white. Now the divine truth is the measure of all truth, for the truth of our intellect is measured by the thing that is outside the mind. Since our intellect is said to be true from the very fact that it accords with the thing, and the truth of a thing is measured according to the divine intellect, which is the cause of things, as we shall prove further on, even as the truth of art products is measured by the art of the craftsman, for then is a casket true when it accords with art. Also, since God is the first intellect and the first intelligible, it follows that the truth of every intellect must be measured by his truth if each thing is measured by the first in its genus, as the philosopher teaches in 10 Metaphysics. Hence the divine truth is the first, supreme and most perfect truth. Chapter 63. The arguments of those who would deny to God the knowledge of singulars. Now there are some who endeavor to withhold knowledge of singulars from the perfection of God's knowledge, and in support of their contention they proceed by 7 ways. The first is from the very nature of singularity. For since the principle of singularity is signate matter, it seems impossible for singulars to be known by an immaterial power, if all knowledge result from some kind of assimilation. Wherefore in us those powers alone which use material organs apprehend singulars, for instance the imagination, the senses and so on, while our intellect, since it is immaterial, knows not singulars. Much less, therefore, is the divine intellect cognizant of singulars, since it is furthest removed from matter. Hence by no means does it seem possible that God should know singulars. The second argument is that singulars are not always. Either therefore they are always known by God, or they are known at one time and unknown at another. The first is impossible, since about what is not there can be no knowledge, which is always about true things, and things which are not cannot be true. The second is also impossible, because the knowledge of the divine intellect is altogether unchangeable, as we have proved. The third argument proceeds from the fact that singulars do not all happen of necessity, but some contingently. Wherefore there can be no certain knowledge about them except when they are. For certain knowledge is that which cannot be deceived, and every knowledge of contingencies, since these are future, can be deceived because the event may prove the opposite of that to which the mind holds. Since if the opposite could not happen, they would be necessary. Wherefore we can have no knowledge of future contingencies, but only a kind of conjectural estimate. Now we must suppose that all God's knowledge is most certain and infallible, as we have proved above. Moreover, it is impossible that God begin anew to know something, on account of his unchangeableness, as stated. Hence it would seem to follow that he knows not contingent singulars. The fourth is based on the fact that the will is the cause of certain singulars. Now an effect, until it actually is, cannot be known save in its cause, for only thus can it be before it begins to be in itself. But the movements of the will cannot be known for certain by anyone except the willer in whose power they are. Wherefore it seems impossible for God to have eternal knowledge of such singulars as have their cause in the will. The fifth proceeds from the infinity of singulars. For the infinite as such is unknown, because whatever is known is, in a way, measured by the comprehension of the knower, since measurement is nothing else than a kind of certification of the thing measured. Wherefore every act discards the infinite. Now singulars are infinite, at least in potentiality. Therefore it seems impossible for God to know singulars. The sixth proceeds from the pettiness of singulars. For as the excellence of knowledge is gauged by the excellence of its object, so apparently the pettiness of the object conduces to pettiness of knowledge. Now the divine intellect is supremely excellent. Therefore it is incompatible with its excellence that God should know the most trivial of singulars. The seventh argues from the presence of evil in certain singulars. For since the thing known is, in a manner, in the knower, and since evil cannot be in God, as proved above, it would seem to follow that evil and privation are entirely unknown to God, and known only by an intellect that is in potentiality, since privation can only be in that which is potential. Hence it follows that God has no knowledge of singulars wherein evil and privation are to be found. Chapter 64. Order of the things to be said about the divine knowledge. In order to refute this error, and moreover to show the perfection of the divine knowledge, we must carefully seek the truth about each of the aforesaid arguments, so as to disprove whatever is contrary to the truth. In the first place, then, we shall show that the divine intellect knows singulars; secondly, that it knows things that actually are not; thirdly, that it knows future contingencies with an unerring knowledge; fourthly, that it knows the movements of the will; fifthly, that it knows infinite things; sixthly, that it knows all the most trivial and petty things; seventhly, that it knows all evils and privations or defects. Chapter 65. That God knows singulars. Accordingly, we shall prove first that God cannot be lacking in the knowledge of singulars, for it has been shown that God knows other things in as much as He is their cause. Now God's effects are singular things because God causes things in the same way as He makes them to be actual, and universals are not subsistent, but have their being only in singulars, as is proved in 7 Metaphysics. Therefore God knows things other than Himself not only in the universal but also in the singular. Again, as soon as one knows the constituent principles of a thing's essence, one must needs know that thing. Thus knowledge of the rational soul and of such a body implies knowledge of man. Now the essence of a singular is made up of signate matter and an individual form. Thus the essence of Socrates is made up of this particular body and this particular soul. Even as the essence of man in general is made up of soul and body, as stated in 7 Metaphysics. Wherefore, since the latter are included in the definition of man in general, so would the former be included in the definition of Socrates, if he could be defined. Hence whoever has knowledge of matter, and of those things whereby matter is designated, and of the form individualized by matter, cannot be lacking in knowledge of the singular. Now God's knowledge reaches to matter, individualizing accidents and forms. For, since His act of understanding is His essence, it follows that He understands all that is in any way whatever in His essence wherein are virtually, as in their first origin, all that have being in any way whatever, forasmuch as He is the first and universal principle of being. And among these we must include matter and accident, since matter is being in potentiality, and accident, being in another. Therefore God lacks not knowledge of singulars. Moreover, the nature of a genus cannot be known perfectly unless its first differences and proper passions be known. Thus the nature of number would not be perfectly known if odd and even were unknown. Now universal and singular are differences or proper passions of being. Therefore if God, in knowing His essence, knows perfectly the common nature of being, it follows that He knows perfectly the universal and the singular. But, Just as he would not know the universal perfectly, if he knew the intention of universality without knowing the thing in the universal, such as man or animal, so too he would not know the singular perfectly if he knew the nature of singularity without knowing this or that singular thing. Therefore God must needs know singulars. Again, just as God is his very being, so is he his own act of knowledge, as we have proved. Now from the fact that he is his own being, it follows that in him are all the perfections of being as in the first source of being, as we have shown above. Therefore it follows that every perfection of knowledge is found in his knowledge, as in the first fount of knowledge. But this would not be if he were lacking in the knowledge of singulars, since the perfection of some knowers consists in this. Therefore it is impossible for him not to have knowledge of singulars. Further, in every order of powers it is universally found that the higher power extends to more things and yet is but one, whereas the lower power extends to fewer things, and yet is multiple in relation to them. This appears in the imaginative power and sense, for the one power of imagination extends to all the things of which the five senses take cognizance, and to more besides. Now the cognitive power in God is higher than in man. Therefore whatever man knows by various powers, his intellect namely, imagination, and sense, God considers it by his one simple intellect. Therefore he knows singulars, which we apprehend by sense and imagination. Moreover, God's intellect does not derive its knowledge from things as ours does; rather is he the cause of things by his knowledge, as we shall prove further on. Wherefore his knowledge of other things is after the manner of practical knowledge. Now practical knowledge is not perfect unless it extend to singulars, because the end of practical knowledge is operation, which is about singulars. Therefore the divine knowledge of other things extends to singulars. Again, the first movable is moved by a motor that moves by intellect and appetite, as was shown above. Now a motor by intellect cannot cause movement unless it knows the movable as naturally inclined to local movement, and that is as existing here and now, and consequently as a singular. Wherefore the intellect that is the motor of the first movable knows the first movable as a singular. But this motor is either supposed to be God, and thus our point is proved, or else it is something beneath God. And if the intellect of this motor is able by its own power to know a singular which our intellect is unable to know, much more will the divine intellect be able to do so. Again, the agent is more excellent than the patient and the thing done, as act is more excellent than potentiality. Wherefore a form of lower degree cannot by its action transmit its likeness to a higher degree, whereas a higher form is able by its action to transmit its likeness to a lower degree. Thus corruptible forms are produced in this lower world by the incorruptible agency of the stars, while a corruptible agency cannot produce an incorruptible form. Now all knowledge is the result of assimilation between knower and known, yet there is this difference, that in human knowledge assimilation is brought about by the action of sensible things on the human cognitive powers, whereas contrariwise in God's knowledge it arises from the action of the form of the divine intellect on things known. Accordingly the form of a sensible object, being individualized by its materiality, is unable to transmit the likeness of its singularity to that which is altogether immaterial, and it can only reach those powers which use material organs. But it is transmitted to the intellect by virtue of the active intellect, insofar as it is wholly stripped of material conditions, and so the likeness of the singularity of a sensible form cannot reach as far as the human intellect. On the other hand, the likeness of the form in the divine intellect, since it extends to the smallest details to which his casualty extends, reaches to the singularity of a sensible and material form. Therefore the divine intellect can know singulars, whereas the human intellect cannot. Further, if God knows not singulars which even men know, this would involve the absurdity which the philosopher urges against Empedocles, namely that God is most foolish. The truth which we have established is confirmed by the authority of Holy Writ, for it is written, neither is there any creature invisible in his sight. The contrary error is rejected, saying not, I shall be hidden from God, and who shall remember me from on high. From what we have said it is also clear how the objection, in the contrary sense does not conclude aright, for that which the divine intellect understands, although immaterial, is nevertheless the likeness of both the matter and the form, as the first productive principle of both. Chapter 66. That God knows the things that are not. In the next place we must show that God lacks not the knowledge of things that are not, for as stated above, the divine knowledge stands in the same relation to the things known, as things knowable to our knowledge. Now the comparison of the thing knowable to our knowledge is that the knowable thing may exist without our having knowledge of it, whereof the philosopher, in the Predicaments, gives the example of squaring the circle, but not conversely. Wherefore the relation of the divine knowledge to things must be such that it can also relate to non-existent things. Again, the knowledge of God's intellect stands in the same relation to other things as the knowledge of a craftsman to the works of his craft, since he is cause of things by his knowledge. Now the craftsman by the knowledge of his art knows even those things which are not yet produced by his art, since the forms of his art pass from his knowledge into external matter so as to produce the works of his art, and consequently nothing prevents forms which have not yet materialized outwardly from being in the craftsman's knowledge. Therefore nothing prevents God from having knowledge of things that are not. Further, God knows things other than himself by his essence, inasmuch as he is the likeness of the things that proceed from him, as shown above. But, since God's essence is infinitely perfect, as proved above, while all things else have limited being and perfection, it is impossible for all other things together to equal the perfection of the divine essence. Wherefore it is capable of representing many things besides those that exist. Hence if God knows the whole power and perfection of his essence, his knowledge extends not only to those things that are, but also to those that are not. Moreover, our intellect, in respect of the operation by which it knows what a thing is, can have knowledge of those things also that are not actually, since it is able to comprehend the essence of a lion or horse, even if all such animals were slain. Now the divine intellect knows, as one who knows what a thing is, not only definitions but also enunciations, as shown above. Therefore it can have knowledge of those things also that are not. Again, an effect can be foreknown in its cause even before it exists. Even so an astronomer foreknows a future eclipse by observing the order of the heavenly movements. Now God's knowledge is of all things through their cause, for by knowing himself, who is the cause of all, he knows other things as his effects, as we proved above. Therefore, prevents him from knowing those things also that are not yet. Moreover, there is no succession in God's act of understanding, any more than there is in his existence. Hence it is all at once everlasting, which belongs to the essence of eternity, whereas the duration of time is drawn out by the succession of before and after. Wherefore the proportion of eternity to the whole duration of time is as the proportion of the indivisible to the continuous. Not indeed of the indivisible that is the term of the continuous, and is not present to each part of the continuous, for such is likened to an instant of time, but of the indivisible that is outside the continuous, and yet synchronizes with each part of the continuous, or with each point of a signate continuous, because, since time does not exceed movement, eternity, being utterly outside movement, is altogether outside time. Again, since the being of the eternal never fails, eternity synchronizes with every time or instant of time. Somewhat of an example of this may be seen in the circle, for a given point in the circumference, although indivisible, does not coincide in its position with any other point, since the order of position results in the continuity of the circumference, while the center which is outside the circumference is directly opposite any given point in the circumference. Accordingly whatever exists in any part of time, is coexistent with the eternal as though present thereto, although in relation to another part of time it is present or future. Now a thing cannot be present to, and coexistent with, the eternal, except with the whole eternal, since this has no successive duration. Therefore whatever happens throughout the whole course of time is seen as present by the divine intellect in its eternity. And yet that which is done in some part of time was not always in existence. It remains therefore that God has knowledge of those things which are not as yet in relation to the course of time. By these arguments it is made clear that God has knowledge of not-beings. Nevertheless, not-beings have not all the same relation to his knowledge. For those things which neither are, nor shall be, nor have been, are known by God as possible to his power. Wherefore he knows them, not as existing in themselves in any way, but as merely existing in the divine power. Such things are said by some to be known to God according to his knowledge of simple intelligence. On the other hand, things which to us are present, past, or future, are known to God as being not only in his power, but also in their respective causes, and in themselves. Of such things God is said to have knowledge of vision, because God sees the existence of things which, in relation to us, are not as yet, not only in their causes but also in themselves, inasmuch as his eternity is by its indivisibility present to all time. Yet God knows every manner of a thing's being by his essence, for his essence is capable of being represented by many things that neither are, nor shall be, nor have been. Moreover, it is the likeness of every cause's power, in respect of which effects pre-exist in their causes. And the being that every single thing has in itself is drawn as a copy from him. Wherefore God knows not beings in so far as they have being after a fashion, either in the divine power, or in their causes, or in themselves. And this is not contrary to the essential conditions of knowledge. The authority of Holy Writ also bears witness to the foregoing, for it is written, "All things were known to the Lord God before they were created, so also after they were perfected he knoweth all things, and before I formed thee in the womb, I knew thee." It is clear from what has been said, that we are not compelled to say, as some have said, that God knows all singulars universally, because he knows them in their universal causes only, even as one who knows a particular eclipse, not as this particular one, but as resulting from opposition, since it has been proved that the divine knowledge extends to singulars as existing in themselves. Chapter 67. That God knows future contingent singulars. From the foregoing it is already somewhat evident that from eternity God has had unerring knowledge of singular contingencies, and that nevertheless they cease not to be contingent. For contingency is not incompatible with certainty of knowledge except in so far as it is future, and not as it is present, because a contingency, while future, may not be, so that the knowledge of one who thinks it will be, may be wrong, and it will be wrong if what he thinks will be, will not be. From the moment however that it is, for the time being it cannot not be, although it may not be in the future, but this affects the contingency, not as present but as future. Hence sense loses nothing of its certainty when it sees that a man is running, although this statement is contingent. Accordingly all knowledge that bears on a contingency as present, can be certain. Now the vision of the divine intellect from eternity sees each thing that happens in time as though it were present, as we have shown above. It follows that nothing prevents God having unerring knowledge of contingencies from eternity. Again, the contingent differs from the necessary according as each is in its cause, for the contingent is in its cause in such a way that it may not result, or may result therefrom, whereas the necessary cannot but result from its cause. But according as each of them is in itself, they differ not as to being, on which the true is founded, because there is not in the contingent, considered as it is in itself, being and not being, but only being, although it is possible for the contingent not to be in the future. Now the divine intellect knows things from eternity, not only as to the being which they have in their causes, but also as to the being which they have in themselves. Therefore nothing prevents it having eternal and unerring knowledge of contingencies. Moreover, even as the effect follows certainly from a necessary cause, so does it from a complete contingent cause unless it be hindered. Now, since God knows all things, as was proved above, he knows not only the causes of contingencies, but also that which may possibly hinder them. Therefore he knows certainly whether contingencies be or not. Again, an effect does not happen to exceed its cause, but sometimes it falls short of it. Hence, since in us knowledge is caused from things, it happens at times that we know necessary things, by way not of necessity but of probability. Now, just as with us things are the cause of knowledge, so the divine knowledge is the cause of the things known. Nothing therefore prevents things whereof God has necessary knowledge being contingent in themselves. Further, an effect cannot be necessary if its cause be contingent, for it would follow that an effect exists after its cause has been removed. Now the ultimate effect has both a proximate and a remote cause. Hence if the proximate cause be contingent, its effect must needs be contingent, even though the remote cause be necessary. Thus plants do not necessarily bear fruit, although the motion of the sun is necessary on account of the contingent intermediate causes. But God's knowledge, although it is the cause of the things it knows, is nevertheless their remote cause. Wherefore the contingency of the things it knows does not militate with its necessity, since it happens that the intermediate causes are contingent. Again, God's knowledge would not be true and perfect, if things happen not in the same way as God knows them to happen. Now God, since He is cognizant of all being, whereof He is the source, knows each effect not only in itself, but also in its relation to every one of its causes. But the relation of contingencies to their proximate causes is that they result from them contingently. Therefore God knows that certain things happen and that they happen contingently. Wherefore the certainty and truth of the divine knowledge do not take away the contingency of things. It is therefore clear from what has been said how we are to refute the objection, gainsaying God's knowledge of contingencies. For change in that which is subsequent does not argue changeableness in that which precedes, since it happens that contingent ultimate effects result from necessary first causes. Now the things known to God do not precede His knowledge, as is the case with us, but are subsequent thereto. Therefore it does not follow that, if what is known to God be changeable, His knowledge can err or in any way be changeable. It will therefore be a fallacy of consequence if, because our knowledge of changeable things is changeable, we think that this happens in all knowledge. Again, when we say God knows or knew this future thing, we imply a kind of middle term between the divine knowledge and the thing known, namely the time at which the statement is made, in relation to which God is said to know is future. But it is not future in relation to the divine knowledge, which existing in the moment of eternity, is related to all things as though they were present. In relation to that knowledge, if we set aside the time at which the statement is made, there is no saying that the thing is known as non-existent, so as to allow of the question being raised as to whether it is possible for the thing not to be, but it will be said to be known by God as already seen in its existence. This being supposed, there is no room for the aforesaid question, since what is already cannot, as regards that instant, not be. The fallacy arises then from the fact that the time at which we speak is coexistent with eternity, as also does past time, which is designated when we say God knew. Wherefore the relation of past or present to future time is ascribed to eternity, which is altogether inapplicable thereto. The result is a fallacy of accident. Further, if every single thing is known to God as seen present to Him, that which God knows will be so far necessary as it is necessary that Socrates is sitting from the fact that he is seen to be sitting. Now this is necessary, not absolutely or as some say by necessity of consequent, but conditionally, or by necessity of consequence. For this conditional statement is necessary: if he is seen to sit, he sits. Wherefore if the conditional be rendered categorically, so as to run, that which is seen to sit, necessarily sits, it is clear that if it be referred to the statement, and in a composite sense, it is true, and if referred to the thing and in a divided sense, it is false. And so in these and in all like arguments employed by those who gainsay God's knowledge of contingencies, there is a fallacy of composition and division. That God knows future contingencies is also proved by the authority of Holy Writ. For it is said about the divine wisdom, she knoweth signs and wonders before they be done, and the events of time and ages, and there is nothing hid from His eyes, He seeth from eternity to eternity. And I foretold thee of old, before they came to pass I told thee. Chapter 68. that God knows the movements of the will. In the next place, we must show that God knows our mind's thoughts and our secret wills, for everything, in whatever way it exists, is known by God, inasmuch as He knows His essence, as we have shown above. Now some things are in the soul, and some in things outside the soul, wherefore God knows all these differences of things and whatever is contained under them. Now the things in the soul are those that are in our will or our thought. It remains, therefore, that God knows what we have in our thoughts and wills. Moreover, God so knows other things in knowing His essence, as effects are known through their cause being known. Accordingly, by knowing His essence, God knows all the things to which His casualty extends. Now this extends to the works of the intellect and will, for, since everything acts by its form which gives the thing some kind of being, it follows that the highest source of all being, from which also every form is derived, must be the source of all operation, because the effects of second causes are to be referred in a still higher degree to first causes. Therefore God knows both the thoughts and the affections of the mind. Again, even as His being is first and consequently the cause of all being, so His act of intelligence is first, and consequently the cause of all intellectual operation. Wherefore just as God by knowing His being knows the being of everything, so by knowing His act of intelligence and will, He knows every thought and will. Further, God knows things not only as existing in themselves, but also as existing in their causes, as proved above, for He knows the relation between cause and effect. Now the products of art are in the craftsman through the intellect and will of the craftsman, even as natural things are in their causes through the powers of the causes. For, just as natural things liken their effects to themselves by their active powers, so the craftsman by his intellect gives his handiwork the form whereby it is likened to his art. It is the same with all things done of set purpose. Therefore God knows both our thoughts and our wills. Again, intelligible substances are no less known to God than sensible substances are known to Him or to us, since intelligible substances are more knowable, for as much as they are more actual. Now the informations and inclinations of sensible substances are known both to God and to us. Consequently, since the soul's thought results from its being informed, and since its affection is its inclination towards something, for even the inclination of a natural thing is called its natural appetite, it follows that God knows our secret thoughts and affections. This is confirmed by the testimony of Holy Writ, for it is said in the Psalm, "The searcher of hearts and reins is God, and hell and destruction are before the Lord, how much more the hearts of the children of men." And He knew what was in man. The dominion which the will exercises over its own acts, and by which it is in its power to will and not to will, removes the determination of the power to one thing, and the violence of a cause acting from without, but it does not exclude the influence of a higher cause from which it has being and action. Thus cality remains in the first cause, which is God, in respect of the movements of the will, so that God is able to know them by knowing Himself. Chapter 69. That God knows infinite things. We must next prove that God knows infinite things, for in knowing that He is the cause of things, He knows things other than Himself, as was shown above. Now He is the cause of infinite things, if there be infinite things, since He is the cause of whatever is. Therefore He knows infinite things. Again, God knows His own power perfectly, as was proved above. A power cannot be known perfectly unless all the things to which it extends be known, since its quantity is gauged in a manner according to them. But His power, being infinite as we have shown, to infinite things, therefore God knows infinite things. Moreover, if God's knowledge extends to all things that exist, in whatever way they exist, as we have shown, it follows that He knows not only actual being but also potential being. Now in natural things there is the infinite potentially, although not actually, as the philosopher proves in 3 Physics. Therefore God knows infinite things, even as unity, which is the principle of number, would know infinite species of numbers, if it knew whatever is potentially in it, for unity is every number potentially. Again, God knows other things in His essence as in a prototypical medium. Now since he is infinitely perfect, as was shown above, it is possible for an infinite number of things with finite perfections to be copied from him, since it is impossible for any single one, or any number of copies, to equal the example of their prototype, and thus there always remains some new way in which some copy can imitate it. Nothing therefore prevents him from knowing infinite things by his essence. Further, God's being is his act of understanding. Therefore even as his being is infinite, as shown above, so his act of understanding is infinite. Now as finite is to finite, so is infinite to infinite. If therefore by our act of understanding which is finite we are able to understand finite things, God also by his act of understanding is able to understand infinite things. Moreover, according to the philosopher, an intellect which knows the supremely intelligible knows the less intelligible not less but more, and the reason for this is that the intellect is not corrupted by the excellence of the intelligible, as the sense is, but is the more perfected. Now if we take an infinite number of beings, whether they be of the same species as an infinite number of men or of an infinite number of species, even though some or all of them be infinite in quantity, if this were possible, all of them together would be of less infinity than God, since each one and all together would have being confined and limited to a certain species or genus, and thus would be in some way finite, wherefore it would fall short from the infinity of God who is infinite simply, as we proved above. Therefore, God knows himself perfectly, nothing prevents him from also knowing that infinite number of things. Further, the more efficacious and clear an intellect is in knowing, the greater the number of things is it able to know from one, even as every power, the stronger it is, the more united it is. Now the divine intellect is infinite in efficacy or perfection, as was shown above. Therefore it can know an infinite number of things by one which is his essence. Further, the divine intellect like the divine essence is perfect simply. Wherefore no intellectual perfection is lacking thereto. Now that which our intellect is in potentiality is its intellectual perfection, and it is in potentiality to all intelligible species. But these species are infinite in number, since the species of numbers and figures are infinite. It follows therefore that God knows all like infinite things. Again, since our intellect is cognizant of the infinite in potentiality, for as much as it is able to multiply the species of numbers indefinitely, if the divine intellect knew not also the infinite in act, it would follow either that our intellect knows more things than the divine intellect knows, or that the divine intellect knows not actually all the things that it knows potentially, and each of these is impossible, as proved above. Further, the infinite is repugnant to knowledge in so far as it is incompatible with being counted, for it is in itself impossible, as implying a contradiction, for the parts of the infinite to be numbered. Now the knowledge of a thing by counting its parts belongs to an intellect that knows one part after another in succession, and not to one that understands the various parts together. Since then the divine intellect knows things together without succession, it is no more hindered from knowing the infinite than from knowing the finite. Moreover, all quantity consists in a certain plurality of parts, for which reason number is the first of quantities. Accordingly, where plurality involves no difference, neither does it cause any difference consequent upon quantity. Now in God's knowledge many things are known in the same way as one, since they are known, not by various species, but by one which is God's essence. Wherefore many things are known by God simultaneously, and consequently plurality makes no difference in God's knowledge. Neither therefore does the infinite which is consequent upon quantity. Therefore knowledge, whether of infinite or of finite things, differs not to the divine intellect, and consequently, since it knows finite things, nothing prevents it from knowing also infinite things. The words of the psalm are in agreement with this, and of his wisdom there is no number. From the foregoing it is clear why our intellect knows not the infinite, as the divine intellect does. For our intellect differs from the divine intellect in four aspects, which constitute this difference. In the first place, our intellect is simply finite, whereas the divine intellect is infinite. Secondly, our intellect knows different things by different species, wherefore it cannot grasp infinite things by one knowledge, as the divine intellect can. The third difference results from the fact that our intellect, since it knows different things by different species, cannot know many things at the same time, so that it cannot know an infinite number of things except by taking them one after the other. Whereas it is not so in the divine intellect, which considers many things simultaneously, as seen by one species. Fourthly, because the divine intellect is about things that are and things that are not, as we proved above, it is also clear how the saying of the philosopher that the infinite as such is unknown, is not in contradiction with this statement. For since, as he says, the notion of infinity is becoming to quantity, the infinite would be known as such, if it were known by the measuring of its parts, because this is proper knowledge of quantity. But God does not know thus. Wherefore, so to say, he knows the infinite, not as such, but in as much as in comparison with his knowledge it is finite, as we have shown. It must be observed, however, that God does not know infinite things by his knowledge of vision, to use the expression employed by others, because the infinite neither is, nor was, nor will be actual, since, according to the Catholic faith, generation is not infinite on either part. Yet he knows the infinite by his knowledge of simple intelligence. For God knows the infinite number of things that neither are, nor will be, nor have been, and nevertheless are in the power of a creature. He knows also the infinite things that are in his power, that neither are, nor have been, nor shall be. Wherefore, as regards the question about the knowledge of singulars, we might reply by denying the major premise, since singulars are not infinite. If, however, they were, God would know them nonetheless. Dash.